Really lovely to be here. Really lovely to see so many of you here. It's fantastic. I've just been at the meeting for those of you who are their first Going for Refuge weekend here at Pamloka. Very, very inspiring just going around, particularly just hearing just a few words from each person about why you're here. It's very, very inspiring. So I want to talk briefly about going forth. I want to just use a simple metaphor and just unpack it a bit. There's a lot I could say about it, but the time is short. So the metaphor I want to use, very, very simple Buddhist metaphor of the path. So the just a little story that basically the path is like being guided home from the pub. So you're drunk, you don't know, you're not in possession of your senses, and you're just being guided home from the pub. Yeah, so you've been at the pub and you're being guided home. And then, but you're being guided on a thin, muddy path between two steep ravines. So you're kind of, you know, singing bad pub songs and railing, or you know, moving between sort of mordant sentimentality and raging against the world. And your guide is saying, "Okay, go left." Is standing behind you, saying, "Go left, go left. No, go right, go right." And you get more and more annoyed at the different instructions. You know, you just say, "Hang on, a minute ago you said to go left, and now you're saying to go right." Yeah. So that's a wonderful picture of what the Dharma life is. that's all you need to know. You're going home from the pub. You're drunk, so you need to realise that you're drunk, and you need someone to guide you home. And because you're walking on this very thin, muddy path between two steep ravines, it's very dangerous. And you don't realise the danger you're in. Yeah, that's what the metaphor is trying to say. You're in a very dangerous position. You're lucky enough to have someone to guide you home. And the metaphor of home, obviously, is a metaphor of the hearth, of what your home really is, what the human home really constitutes. Somebody actually knows what home is, knows where you really live, and guides you. They know the danger you're in, but because you don't, it sounds to you like you're getting contradictory advice. You're being told to go right, and then suddenly you're being told to go left. Yeah, and you'll find that on as you move towards ordination and well beyond ordination, that you'll feel that you're being given contradictory advice from Bhante, from the Buddha, from your friends. Because of this nature of the path, yeah. So obviously, in this metaphor, the ravines represent eternalism on one side and nihilism on the other. That's really what the metaphor is trying to get at. Although, I think it's saying something much deeper than that, and that you're on this really muddy, slippery, thin path between the sliding slope down to eternalism and then down to nihilism on the other side. So I've been thinking about this recently, and I think it's better to think that on the right-hand side you've got eternalism, which I think you could just simply call religion, the slip into religion. And by religion I mean the slip into certainty. Schopenhauer said that all religions teach certainty, and certitude is not possible in this life. Given the nature of our human situation, given the nature of our senses, through his philosophy, he said that we're living in a universe in which certitude isn't possible. So something that teaches certitude is, by definition, lying to you. So I think of the right-hand slide is the slide towards religion and any kind of religious certitude, because human life doesn't allow for certitude. It allows for Shraddha, but it doesn't allow for certitude. On the left, then, is the slip down to nihilism. But I'm thinking of this more and more in terms of the secular, that you have religion on the right and secularism on the left, which is a slide down to believing that your common sense ideas, the person you think you are, what you think life is really the case. this sort of arrogant certainty sometimes that ordinary day-to-day consciousness is all with God. Is it to mean? I think at the moment the great danger in the Dharma for the West is towards the slide into secularism rather than the slide into religion. And that will probably change again. At one time, earlier even in the movement, there was a more and more of a sort of interest in Tibetan Buddhism, and I think at times that was sliding towards the danger of religion, so that Buddha figures were beginning to be literal deities almost. A sort of into superstition, into a sort of pseudo certitude. But I don't think that's the danger at the moment. The danger seems to be mainly a slide into secularism and its narrowness. The two areas I'm particularly aware of is I'm teaching MBAs, mindfulness-based approaches at the LBC. Particularly I've been teaching mindfulness-based cognitive therapy for depression. It's a really, really good course, and I'd very much recommend it, even if you've never experienced depression. It's a very accurate, very useful application of an aspect of mindfulness to this huge issue of depression. But if you're not careful, if it's taught badly, if you take it up badly, if you're not taught by people who have confidence in the greater Dharmic perspective, it ends up with a kind of secularism if you're not careful. Particularly, I've noticed it something within it wants to move away from the mess of human emotions and human interaction. You don't need a community to practice MBAs. You don't need an order to practice them. And it doesn't emphasize altruistic activity. And none of those things, I don't mean those as a criticism. It just isn't trying to do those things. Yeah. But I think we have to be wary of taking the metaphor of mindfulness literally. I'm coming to really dislike mindfulness, despite having written a book on it. I don't think it's a subject, but that's a whole other talk in itself. And then the other thing that I've been noticing is this interest in insight in the movement, in the order, and outside of that, particularly things like Liberation Unleashed and so on. And I don't know the pros and cons of it, but what strikes me again is that you don't need an order, you don't need a community. It doesn't emphasize altruistic activity. I think it slides into secularism, that really the great mysteries of life can be worked out in your own head in private, which fits our modern individualistic worldview very, very, very neatly. Yeah. So I think at the moment the danger is that we slide on this muddy slide down towards secularism and mistake that for Buddhism. And then, of course, there'll be a reaction to that and people will start sliding towards religion and mistake that for Buddhism. The path of Buddhism, I mean, really what the metaphor is trying to get to is that that's the middle way, above and beyond those two dangers of secularism on the left, and it is on the left, I think, along with, you know, all the things that go with that, and religion and certitude on the right, and conservatism and so on the right. The path of the Dharma is above and beyond those. It's the middle way. The middle way isn't an ideology. It's not even something you can learn by studying Buddhism. You can study Buddhism and still not have a sense of the middle way. It's much more like a homing beacon, a modern metaphor might put it, that you're trying to feel in touch with a homing beacon of which you're trying to walk this narrow path between religion and secularism. It's a feel, and as you all know by now, you catch that feel from other people who have caught that feel. It's an attitude to life. It's even a certain sort of aesthetic almost. You need to feel it. It's not an ideology. You can't learn the middle way. Yeah. It's not a position you can take. Not really, I don't think. So this path then from the pub to home is a path that goes above and beyond the danger of slipping into religious certitude on the right and slipping into secular narrowness on the left. It's above and beyond that distinction. And of course it's a path of ever-increasing renunciation. The metaphor is of leaving the pub, leaving a sort of set world of habitual interactions, a certain, you know what it's like in a pub where you can chat to a certain point, but it doesn't allow for real friendship, it doesn't allow for the great questions of life. It's a kind of social trap. So it's moving away from that to home, and home, as I said, I think is your real home, where we're only finally at home, which of course is the Buddha. So it's always a movement of a renunciation. And the main way I wanted to emphasize that just briefly now is it's a movement from away from worldly attitudes, behaviors, metaphors, mainly worldly attitudes and behaviors. I'm struck by how difficult it is not to be a worldly person. Whether you're living here at Padmaloka, whether you're living at home with your family, very, very difficult not to be just worldly. One of the great dangers of the Dharma is that you can use the language of the Dharma just to sugar over your basically worldly life. Very, very easy to do. You can get better and better at talking about the Dharma, but your life can be thoroughly conventional. So I think that path is always a path of being less and less conventional. And the trouble is the way of being conventional now is being unconventional. It's being individual rather than a conformist and so forth. Our way of being conventional at the moment is to look different. So it's a very difficult thing to talk about because our whole ethos is about how different we are from each other and how we have unique individualities with choices. But that is actually terribly, terribly conventional. It'd be much more unconventional to give yourself to an institution or even help create an institution. That's very unconventional now. Once upon a time, that was very conventional, if in the Victorian times, but we may never survive the Victorians. But now that would be very unconventional, to come and live here and give yourself to an institution like Padmaloka to come and work at the London Buddhist Centre. That's very, very unconventional now, because you have to cooperate with other people. You have to renounce your cherished individualism. I have to renounce that. So it's a path, isn't it, away from a worldly attitudes, worldly behaviours, but particularly a worldly outlook. You can be married with family and still not have a worldly outlook, worldly behaviour. You can still be living a radical life. I know people who do. I think it's more difficult to, but I definitely know people who do. You can live an apparently Buddhist life and still be very, very worldly. So I think we need to be really looking and helping each other move away from worldly behaviour, which even that could be misunderstood, because so often it ends up with, I don't know, the unworldly thing is to choose eco-va rather than ordinary washing up. That's a sort of far as we go sometimes. Being unworldly is more to do with dedicating yourself ongoingly to Dharma practice. Of course, the other problem with this metaphor is that in the story, it's a lovely little story, it's a guide guiding one person, guiding you home. You're drunk, you've got somebody behind them, presumably with a hand on your shoulder saying, no, go left a bit, right a bit, right a bit. Right. Actually, I think it'd be better if you thought that it was a group of people, yeah. A whole band of drunkards, which would make it actually a better metaphor, because it just shows you how tricky it is to stay on the path. Because you can push each other off, or you can help each other on, and trying to get everybody on that little narrow, muddy path is very, very tricky. Yeah? So I think it'd be better to think it as a whole gaggle of drunkards. And that's effectively what the order is, really. Doesn't seem as inspiring as you might have wished, but it's a gaggle of drunkards trying to get home. Joining the order is deciding, actually, That's the only thing I can manage. You know? I can't be a Buddha. I can't gain insight on my own. I can't just do a coping breathing space every 3 minutes. The only thing I can do is get a gaggle of drunkards who do actually vaguely want to go home, although they also vaguely want to go back to the pub. But perhaps together we can sort of convince each other and ourselves that let's keep going home rather than go back to the pub. And sometimes three of your friends go to the pub and you have to go back and get them and all that sort of thing. That's really what the order is, and what the order means is that some of those, that gaggle of drunkards, are less drunk than others. It's really as simple as that. You can't do it without that context. You cannot go home without that context. If you try to go home on your own, you'll just go back to the pub, or you'll go somewhere that you think is home, but it's really just another conventional setup, even a conventional religious setup. I need to practice with you. I cannot do it without you, and you can't do it without me, so to speak. I think this becomes more and more important as you practice the Dharma life. It's very touching, just coming from this meeting, how much inspiration there is in everybody talking, how much people felt in contact with their suffering, and that the Dharma is the answer to that. But once you're ordained, particularly for a number of years, you can really lose sense of that. Very, very difficult to continue with beginner's mind, and that's what we all need, is to continue with beginner's mind. So we really just need each other, primarily. And more than we need mindfulness, we need each other. Yeah? So that's what the order is. And of course the guide is Bhante, Sangharakshita, our teacher. He's the one who knows where home is. He's the one who knows where our home really is. I remember when I first heard a tape lecture on my first weekend retreat, when I was 25. I think it was his lecture, Breaking Through to Buddhahood. And listening to this tape lecture, which we did in those days, I felt that Bhante knew me better than I knew myself. I remember thinking, how did he know this about me? How did he understand me so much? And how did he say, here's what your issues in your life are, aren't they? Here's what you need to do. So Bhante is your guide. The Buddha isn't your guide. In some sort of versions of this metaphor, what you've got is a narrow path, I think between a river of fire and a river of ice. Again, this sort of binary thing. You've got robbers chasing you, which is obviously death, robbers and murderers chasing you from behind. But at the end of your path, you've got Amitabha calling you. And again, I was very struck when I think about this, that Amitabha is red, the colour of the hearth and home. Amitabha represents your real home, which is the home of love, universal love. Yeah? And it's Amitabha that's calling you. So I think for us, it's the Buddha that's calling us. On the shrine there, he's calling us. But we need a human, historical teacher who lives in our time in the West, you know, understands the Buddha's call in this particular context. Yeah. So the Buddha is calling us, but it's Bhante that guides us. So as you are progressing towards ordination, and if you're already ordained, you need to come to terms with the guide. You need to study him. I'd really particularly recommend reading the seminars, because I think you meet Bhante very, very deeply in the seminars. He's not a conventional Buddhist teacher, and if you try to make him one, you'll make him a smaller man. He's much more than a conventional Buddhist teacher. You won't like a lot of the things he says. At least you shouldn't do, because they're very, very concerning when you read some of them. But he is your teacher. You need to come to terms with him and learn to love him, because then only then will you follow his guide. Learning to love Bhante doesn't mean liking him always, and it doesn't even always mean agreeing with him. There's been a lot of discussion in our order about discipleship, and I feel that we're easily missing the point, either for it or against it. It's something more than I can easily express, certainly in this length of talk. He is the beloved teacher, but that doesn't mean to say what people fear it means, which is that you'll do everything he says. It means like anyone that you love, that you want to do what he says, and sometimes you won't want to and you don't. It's not the same as liking his taste and so on. It's something much, much more than that. You can't really ever describe what the teacher is, but he is our guide. Don't think he isn't, he is. Whether you like him or not, whether you agree with him or not, whatever you think about his actions in the past, he is our guide, without which we would be lost, or more lost than we already are, more drunk than we already are. So that's what we're doing. We're on a path. We're on a slippery path, a muddy path. It's very, very difficult to stay on the path. Very, very difficult, especially after ordination. It's much easier before ordination. After ordination, it's more difficult to stay on the path because you think you've already got something. Actually, what you've got is the beginnings of the path. Very, very difficult to stay on the path. To stay on the path, you need to be with others as much as possible. I need to come to Pamaloka as much as possible. I need to live with my friends as much as possible. I need to teach the Dharma as much as possible. I need to live with this bunch of drunken men and women who are trying to move towards the Buddha. And I need to listen to, my beloved teacher and love him more and more as I try to traverse the path. The reason I've said all this is because my fear at the moment is what I'm thinking of as the great sleep of Western Buddhism. I think there's a real danger of what I imagine to be the great sleep of Western Buddhism. Just when the world is becoming more open, particularly the West, more open to Buddhism than ever before, it could just nod off into Buddhism becoming just a way of nuancing your consumer choices. So that instead of flying, you go on a plane, instead of washing up with whatever ferry you use, Ecova, it just becomes something that is nuancing consumer choices, but doesn't challenge the whole status quo. So if we're not careful, with the best will in the world, Buddhism, when it's at last becoming a real voice in the modern West, could actually, because of that, fall asleep and become part of the institution in a pejorative way. The only way we can stop that happening is for us to practice together, to really relish what we have, relish our Sangha, relish our Dharma, and relish our guide, our teacher. So on this weekend, 13 men are going to be doing a going for ceremony, which represents that they're really now committing themselves to that path. 13 men can do a lot of things. That 13 men can make a huge difference to the world if they're really dedicated to the world, if they really go for refuge to the three jewels, not just today and tomorrow, but for the rest of their life. And by golly, that's such a challenge to any of us, to all of us. They can make a huge difference, but it's not very many 13 people. The world is burning, probably like never before. I think we're in an extremely dangerous situation. We need, what the world needs more than anything is a community that goes beyond all kinds of differences and that are going home from the pub. Thank you.
Great, thank you very much, Maitreya Bandhu, for a very stimulating talk, and particularly for bringing out the importance of Sangharakshita as our teacher and our guide, and also the importance of practicing collectively and keeping our practice radical, keeping going forth. And our second speaker is Sardaloka, and I've lived with Sardaloka for about 13 years now, and I feel very fortunate to have lived with him for that time, and I've learnt a lot from him. And Sardaloka's talk is entering into the Dharma life. And from living with Sardaloka, I know for sure that he's entered very deeply into the Dharma life and continues to do so, and continues to keep that radical edge to his practice. So, as far as I can see, much of his life is concerned about spreading the Dharma and establishing the order and the movement. And he does that through helping men to get ordained, helping them after ordination, but also spreading the Dharma in Finland, Estonia, the Ukraine and Russia. And he does that through personal connections and through making personal connections and friendships with those people. And so I can't think of anyone better to speak on entering into the life of the Dharma. Sadaloka.
So yes, the title of this talk is Entering into a Life in the Dharma. Actually, every talk you've heard around Tri Ratna is about this. Everything we do in Tri Ratna is about this. Everything we do, all our talks are concerned, all our practice is concerned with entering more and more deeply into a life in the Dharma, with living more and more in accord with the way things really are, as first discovered, uncovered by the historical Buddha, and further explored, opened up by his disciples down over the centuries to the present day. But entering more and more deeply into a life in the Dharma isn't straightforward. It's much easier to say than to do, as I think Maitreya Bandhu's talk intimated. Because there are these powerful forces within us, around us, that bend and distort reality and that lead us into craving, hatred, confusion and suffering. So even when we come across the Dharma, we have this strong heartfelt response to it, which I know many of you have had. This deep sense of recognition, of coming home, this feeling, this is it, this is what I've been looking for, this is what gives life meaning. Still we get distracted constantly, pulled this way and that, swamped, confused, and in the heat of the moment, amidst the pressures and pulls of a life, we keep on forgetting what really matters, what's most important. We get caught up in petty concerns, irritations and upsets, in our fears and desires. Way back when, in 1806, William Wordsworth wrote, "The world is too much with us, late and soon. Getting and spending, we lay waste our powers. Little we see in nature that is ours. We have given our hearts away, a sordid boon." Boon is gift. And I think we all know, when we hear those words, we all know exactly what Wordsworth is talking about. Probably actually what he's saying there over 200 years ago is even more true for us today, even more true of the world and the culture we live in. So because it can be so difficult to really hold true to what we know is most important, this is actually why a teacher, teachings, a tradition, a spiritual community, a sangha are so crucial. Why a context to practice in is so important, so essential. Because without this, we're just so easily drawn back into the ways of the world, the conventional attitudes and values of those around us. We lose sight of the Dharma, often without even really noticing, without realizing what's going on. There's a very strong image that stays with me that Subhuti gave in a talk many years back when our shrine room was in what is now the dining room. And he spoke of how the sun of our inspiration just slowly sets below the horizon, and we don't even realize it's happened. We just don't quite notice it happen. It just slowly disappears. And it's only when something happens in our life or we go on a retreat again, you know, something wakes something up in us again, and we realise, you know, there was something that we already knew, but we'd lost it, even though it seemed so clear and so obvious. So we should never underestimate Mara. We should never underestimate the strength of those blind instinctive forces, those powerful habitual propensities. There's a phrase, inveterate propensities, I really like. It really captures the sort of strength of those forces in us, those inveterate propensities, those habitual forces at work within us. And also those forces, gross and subtle and insidious, at play in the world around us. So yes, we talk a lot in Tri Ratna about the importance of supportive conditions. And this is a vital principle. But again, you know, the words can just slip so easily off our tongue. You know, we can tick off Mitra study group, Kalyana Mitras, daily meditation practice. It can all become a bit bland. And we can start to reduce Sangha to a sort of spiritual support group. You know, we've got all the things we need in place for our spiritual life. But this human life is much more strange, much more mysterious, much more terrible and beautiful. and a real spiritual life is not so easily managed. Now, just in the same way, we can reel off the conditions, the supportive conditions, just for a decent human life. You know, food, clothing, shelter, healthcare, education. But yeah, what about the craziness, the suffering that can erupt into our lives at any moment? You know, I've got some friends in Odessa, in the Ukraine. And I was talking to them on Skype a few months back. And one of them, Ira, there's a couple, Ira, Dima, and they've got a little daughter, Sophie. Ira was saying, we just didn't realise what a good life we had. We didn't realise, appreciate, you know, how life was, how good our life was until all this war came along. And now we just want that life back. But, you know, they can't get it back. It's not in their hands. You know, life just has this unpredictability. And then, you know, what about love? What about meaning? How to quantify and measure them? So if we're talking about the supportive conditions for even a decent human life, even there there's this tendency to want to simplify, reduce things down, make it manageable, put everything in its place, and life just won't have it. And we have to keep remembering that in this context of Sangha, a spiritual community, in which our own spiritual life unfolds. You know, we have to keep remembering that it's much more than just a repository of teachings and practices, understandings and experience. That's very important. And it's more than good people who can offer guidance, encouragement, support, especially through difficult times. So that too is very important. The context of Sangha actually needs to open up into an atmosphere, a mood, a spirit where the Dharma is increasingly alive between us, where our hearts are opening together in love, wonder, where there's a sense of being on the edge of something strange, mysterious, disturbing, unsettling, and profoundly beautiful and meaningful. Padmavadra mentioned earlier, right at the start, about this extra retreat on the series of talks on the Vimalakirti Nirdesha that Bhante gave back in 1979. Now, how many of you have actually heard those lectures on the Vimalakirti Nirdesha? Just put your hands up if you've heard them. That's not many of you, is it? they're actually really worth listening to. And it actually is really worth listening to Bhante, really worth listening to Sangharakshita. I was talking to someone the other day who said they'd read a lot of Bhante, but they actually just sat and listened to one of his talks with some others in the community recently. And it was quite a revelation just to hear Sangharakshita speaking, you know, just to hear him communicating the Dharma and the warmth and the humour and the depth that came across, just actually hearing him. So, yeah, I really recommend, you know, really listen to Bhante. The talks are all there on Free Buddhist Audio. When I was first around in Norwich in 1979, I just gobbled up whole series of talks from the tape library that we had in the centre there, you know, the Noble Eightfold Path, the Bodhisattva Ideal series, the Sutra of Golden Light series. I just sort of gobbled them up, and just the Dharma just seemed to really open up for me. And I really do recommend, yeah, just listening to Bhante and listening to those talks. Yes, he gave this series on the Vimalakirti Nirdesha in the autumn of 1979, and for one of them, a whole minibus load of us went down from Norwich to hear the talks, and for the rest, you know, as soon as they were available, we'd gather in the centre around a tape recorder and just listen to them. We were sort of hungry for more of the Dharma. And it really is an excellent series. And one of those lectures that really stayed with me is the second lecture on building the Buddha land. And in this series, Bhante begins with a vast cosmic perspective of countless universes. Some of these universes have Buddhas where auspicious conditions have come together, and some don't. And a Buddha land or a Buddha field is the sphere of influence of one Buddha. And he goes on to tell us how, for the Mahayana, there's two kinds of Buddha land. There's pure Buddha lands and there's impure Buddha lands. So pure Buddha lands, like the Sukhavati of Buddha Amitabha, they're incredibly beautiful. Everything there is resonant with the Dharma. Everything there leads into the Dharma. You know, the sound of the birds, the light, the flowers, everything just leads you back into the Dharma. Other Buddha lands, like our own, are impure. You know, they can be dirty, difficult, untidy, a bit rough. And the task of the Bodhisattvas and aspiring bodhisattvas and novice bodhisattvas and so on, is to transform an impure Buddha land into a pure Buddha land. So bodhisattvas, aspiring bodhisattvas, can work together, even over countless lifetimes, to build and purify a Buddha land. And one way of doing this is building an increasingly purified Buddha land or Buddha field in the midst of an impure Buddha field or Buddha land that can just gradually extend its influence outwards. And Bhante makes a striking point as well. He says, a Buddha field of bodhisattvas is a field of living beings. So a Buddha land is built by bodhisattvas, each individually taking responsibility for their own states of mind and actions, and encouraging others to do the same. They're united in and by their individual practice of the Dharma. And Bhante really spells it out. You cannot really help yourself without helping others. And you cannot really help others without helping yourself. And he also points out, we're all creating a world all the time through our actions of body, speech and mind, even if only by passively going along with the others around us. So it's not a question of whether we do or don't create a world. We're doing it, you know, even unconsciously, even blindly. So what we really have to decide is what sort of world do we want to create? You know, that's the question, that's the choice that we have to make. So we could say, in creating the order and movement, Bhante and his disciples and the disciples of his disciples and so on, are seeking to set up a specific network of supportive conditions that make possible and sustain individual and collective going refuge to the three jewels. Yeah, and that sounds good, doesn't it? But for me, much more inspiring and engaging is the language or the idea or the myth of together creating a Buddha land, of together building and purifying a Buddha field of living beings, more and more drawn into the sphere of influence of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. And yes, of course, we have to remember we're untidy creatures. Arloka, who made all these paintings you see around and the Buddha figure here, Arloka used to work with us a lot on going for refuge retreats here, and he'd speak of himself and of us all as a mess in process, a mess in the process of going for refuge to the three jewels. So building a Buddha land isn't easy. You know, it involves engaging more and more deeply with other people on the basis of shared values and vision, which means being open to and even relishing having our own mess revealed and purified, and working with others going through the same process of having their mess revealed and purified. And it's difficult, it's uncomfortable, but it's immensely satisfying and profoundly meaningful. So, in asking for ordination, you're saying you want to join with others and commit yourself wholeheartedly to this task of building a Buddha land, creating a Buddha field. And it means you're actually taking on the practical implications of the recognition that the wisdom of the Buddhas and the compassion of the Buddhas are inseparable. You're recognising that entering into the wisdom that sees through the notion of a fixed, unchanging self and goes beyond all self-clinging has to go hand in hand with cultivating the selfless love and compassion that brings us into vivid connection with all life. And so working together with other beings for the benefit of all beings. Wisdom and compassion are inseparable. Traditionally, they're the two wings of one bird, the Bodhisattva. And, yeah, we all know a bird cannot fly with only one wing. It has to have two wings. So, for Buddhism, wisdom isn't and never can be personal. Something that I or you can obtain and own. Rather, wisdom is a state of being where one is in profound and metaphor connection with all life and all beings. It's dynamic, not static, constantly unfolding, something that we can grow into through working together to build a Buddha land, a Buddha field, and in so doing, bring about the arising of what is spoken of as the bodhicitta. Atisha, one of the figures on our refuge tree, one of the great teachers of Tibet, he and his disciples speak of Shunyata Karuna Garba, the essence of emptiness and compassion, which is another way of speaking about bodhicitta, which makes really explicit this connection between wisdom, emptiness, Shunyata, and compassion, Karuna. Shunyata Karuna Garba, the essence of emptiness and compassion. in our order and movement sometimes, it can seem like we're rehearsing, going through trends and phases in the history of the Buddhist tradition, even in just a few short years, as we seek to really rediscover, under Bhante's guidance, the essence and meaning of the Dharma for ourselves. Now, I ask myself sometimes, why did the Mahayana arise? Why did it have to happen? Looking around, we do live, as has already been noted, in a highly individualistic age, and we're all influenced by this. And recognizing this, I can see all the more clearly why Bhante insists again and again on the Bodhisattva ideal and on the vision of our order as the thousand-armed Avalokiteshvara, which the image is there on the shrine in front of the Buddha. So looking around these days, it's great to see that many really want to go deeper in their meditation. It's very good to see a freshness and immediacy in the way many are approaching awakening, not seeing it as just some impossibly distant goal. But it also would be great to see more and more people, order members and mitras, bringing a greater sense of urgency and interest to becoming kinder, to becoming more forgiving, more deeply ethical, to cultivating a heart overflowing with love and compassion, and trusting that this would of its very nature be imbued with wisdom. It would be wonderful to hear more and more talk of giving up self-preoccupation and concern so that the love and compassion of the Buddhas can flow through us and out into the world. Well, maybe it is already starting to happen, and we can work together to make it happen more and more. So I'm going to finish with a poem from Shabkar. He's a late 18th century, early 19th century Tibetan yogi, very much in the tradition of Milarepa, who you're probably much more familiar with. And this poem sums up, I think, again, the vision and understanding of a great teacher, written very near the end of his life. If a man has compassion, he is a Buddha. Without compassion, he is a lord of death. With compassion, the root of Dharma is planted. Without compassion, the root of Dharma is rotten. One with compassion is kind even when angry. One without compassion will kill even as he smiles. For one with compassion, even his enemies will turn into friends. Without compassion, even his friends turn into enemies. With compassion, one has all dharmas. Without compassion, one has no dharma at all. With compassion, one is a Buddhist. Without compassion, one is worse than a heretic. Even if meditating on voidness, one needs compassion as its essence. A Dharma practitioner must have a compassionate nature. Compassion is the distinctive characteristic of Buddhism. Compassion is the very essence of all dharmas. Great compassion is like a wish-fulfilling gem. Great compassion will fulfill the hopes of self and others. Therefore, all of you, practitioners and lay people, cultivate compassion, and you will achieve Buddhahood. May all men and women who hear this song, with great compassion, benefit all beings.
Thanks very much, Sardloka, for a very moving talk on building the Buddha land and the inseparability of wisdom and compassion. We're going to take a tea break now, and we'll meet in groups at 10 to 12. Could we have a bell at 2:15 so we get the groups for 10 to 12, please? And let's have another round of applause for both our speakers.
Last week's fantastic. Whatever you did, don't
you? Oh, I don't know. Unless you just switch it off.
Do you want to sing this one?
No. Turn it off.